silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Well, good afternoon. We have a new justice on our court today, and so I will introduce the court to all of you. Although many of you know us on the court, I would like to introduce our newest justice today, and we'll begin with Daniel Kelly, who sits at the far my far left. Next to him, Justice Michael Gableman. Next to him, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I am Pat Rogensack, the Chief Justice. On my right is Justice Shirley Abrahamson. Next to her, Justice Annette Ziegler. And on the far right, Justice Rebecca Bradley. With those introductions, are you prepared to begin, counsel? Please do.
Misha Saitlin, Solicitor General on behalf of the Wisconsin Department of Justice. The two training videos at issue in this case are protected from disclosure under the public interest balancing test because of two public interest reasons. First, the need to protect law enforcement techniques. Second, the need to safeguard victims from traumatization and re-traumatization. I'd like to begin first with the disclosure of law enforcement techniques. The two training videos here were recorded as part of a semi-annual program put on by the department, the Wisconsin Department of Justice, to educate prosecutors and Department of Justice personnel on how to catch and prosecute criminals. They are given to a limited audience of prosecutors, DOJ personnel, and some other specifically invited folks. They are not open to the public to enter.
Well, the trial court found that there were some former DAs who are now defense counsel who are in the audience.
Yes, Your Honor.
That was a finding of fact.
Your Honor, at the time of the hearing, of the recordings and presentations, they were in fact prosecutors or DOJ personnel. What occurred is in the several years since, especially since the 2009 video, some of them have then gone on to other career pursuits, but they were not defense attorneys at the time of the presentation, to be absolutely clear.
But they were former DAs, because I checked, there's a roster in this record of one of these sessions, and there were former DAs, not present DAs, and not assistant DAs.
Your Honor, everyone that was there falls into one of a couple categories. There's current DAs and their staff. There was DOJ personnel and their staff. There are people who were specifically invited because they were giving some sort of presentation. And then there were certain victim services personnel who were giving presentations or related to
and
personnel.
And no former DAs?
Well, it may have been that some of them were former DAs and they were serving in a position that would help give one of the presentations or something of that sort.
Okay, but they were present from their non-presentations. They were there listening to these
As I said, Your Honor, everyone that was there was specifically invited for one of the enumerated reasons.
Right.
Even they were being trained because they are
DA personnel. Trainers. Okay.
Right, among those. So in considering the disclosure of law enforcement techniques aspect of this case, I would like this court to keep three general considerations in mind. First, this court in Linsmeyer specifically observed that public records documents that would reveal techniques and procedures from investigations or prosecutions generally overcome the presumption of openness that is embedded in the open records law.
Now, we have a little problem here because you don't say precisely what techniques you're talking about. And how that this would help criminals or defense counsel. And you can't say it because if you said it, you'd reveal it.
Exactly.
And yet in your reply brief, you're highly critical of your opponent for not explaining why these are well-known techniques and that they're not helpful to either criminal defense bar or to the criminals?
Your Honor, what we did in our opening brief, consistent with the need to keep these techniques secure, is provide timestamp citations throughout the videos.
Yeah.
And we then allowed opposing counsel to twice view the same tapes, and they could have addressed the claims that we made at the same level of generality. Certainly they could not reveal the techniques, and that was part of the agreement that we reached. But what only thing that we were critical of is they didn't address any of our timestamp citations. They basically relied upon just quoting the circuit court repeatedly, and they didn't contest the timestamp citations. And with regard to those timestamp citations, I found the following exercise very helpful in understanding the arguments with regard to the law enforcement techniques. Obviously, the court is going to has and will again watch the videos. And what I found helpful is to watch the videos, and as you get to the timestamp, to take a look at what we generally said was going to be
I did that.
Revealed. But then this is the step that I found particularly helpful, which is to think about that not from the frame of mind of a lawyer who's done criminal arguments or justices that have heard many criminal cases, but from the point of view of a pedophile who's attempting to evade law enforcement, who may not be up on these kinds of things like those of us, many of us in this room are. And if this video was posted on a Reddit or some other forum frequented by child pedophiles, frequented by child pornographers, whether seeing that video, where seeing those aspects that we pointed out in the timestamps would be helpful to that individual in attempting to evade capture and prosecution by Wisconsin law enforcement personnel.
There's a presumption of open records, right?
That's correct.
And the burden of proof is on the state to show that they should not be opened, right?
Your Honor.
And what's the burden?
Well, Your Honor, let me say it's a little bit different than that. There is a general presumption of openness for all records.
Right.
And the record custodian, in the first instance, has to weigh that general presumption against the public policy interest that might be at stake. So there's a presumption of openness there, but there can also be a strong public policy in capturing sexual predators. So the record custodian, in the first instance, makes that weighing. Open records, very important policies on one hand. Capturing sexual predators, very important policies on the other hand.
Mm-hmm.
And then this court in Hempel said that in making that weighing, the record custodian has substantial discretion. That's the court's words in Hempel. Now, with regard to when it comes to the courts, it is an issue of de novo review. Basically, this court views the videotapes, takes into account the same public policy rationales that the custodian looked at and makes a de novo determination. Of course, benefiting from the custodian's expertise to the extent they have expertise in this area and benefiting from the understanding that the custodian has substantial discretion, but ultimately it is this court's responsibility conducting de novo review to take a look at these videos, take a look at our claimed bases, and to just make a decision under our open records laws.
So we do the balancing.
That's correct.
The presumption is in favor of open records, and then you have the burden to show the balance is in your favor.
Your Honor, with respect, I don't think that that's how it works. The one side of the balance is presumed. That is, the fact that openness is important.
Mm-hmm.
But when you have a weighty consideration, like capturing sexual predators, it's not like the thumb is somehow on the scale. You look at the weightiness of the interests and how much they are undermined, both how much openness would be undermined and how much capture of sexual predators would be undermined.
You don't have any burden?
No, it's a de novo standard with one side of the balance already provided to the courts by the legislature. And one side.
Your position is no burden.
It's a de novo standard term.
Mm-hmm. Well, so is constitutionality of a statute, but the burden is on the person attacking the constitutionality to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that it's unconstitutional. You don't have that kind of burden here.
I believe it was best said in this court's decision, Hempel, which is that the legislature provides the words exceptional case, and then Hempel decided that means that when the facts are such that the public policy interests favoring non-disclosure outweigh the public policy interest favoring disclosure, notwithstanding the strong public presumption of disclosure. That's really the whole thing. It's not about, this court didn't articulate that in terms of burdens. It articulated in terms of that kind of case-by-case analysis. That's what this court said. And I think that's the clear statement from this court as to what the burdens are in the Hebmel case.
Mr. Saitlin, clearly capturing sex offenders is a weighty and important public function. But how are we to judge the material in this tape to determine whether what's disclosed there would hamper? We don't necessarily have the expertise in ferreting out crime. How do we determine what is going to unnecessarily and unreasonably hamper the ability of our law enforcement officers to capture these criminals?
Thank you, Your Honor. Two observations about that. One, in light of the special expertise the Department of Justice has in capturing, I think there has to be some, not deference, but understanding given about the substantial discretion that we have. But second, there is a body of case law that deals with this very problem, and it is the Federal Exemption 7E case law. And this court in Linsmeyer said that Exemption 7 is a framework that record custodians can use to determine whether law enforcement records will be released. And the Section 7E case law discusses how to make this determination. For example, it says that when techniques are involved, it's a relatively low burden as compared to other things in the federal FOIA. And the reason for that is exactly that. It's when you have law enforcement saying, this is going to be undermining our techniques, it's hard for courts to guess that. Sometimes they do, but it's among the various things that occur in open records or FOIA law. It's on the realm of it's hard to second guess law enforcement.
And we certainly will benefit from the expertise of the Department of Justice, but we also benefit from the opinions of the courts that have looked at this already. And both the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals have decided that the interest in disclosure outweighs the interest asserted by the Department of Justice. How are we to second guess that?
Well, Your Honor, with respect to the lower courts, they made critical fundamental legal errors that undermine their analysis. With regard to techniques, police techniques, which is a little part of the justification we're discussing now, they relied almost exclusively on the notion that these techniques are publicly available. But of course, there's nothing new under the sun. I mean, given the information age, almost every technique is somewhere on the internet, somewhere in some casebook, somewhere in some FBI or some state's training.
What TV program?
Well, Your Honor,
how to catch a sexual perpetrator.
Your Honor, the Circuit Court did reference that TV show. Nothing about that TV show was in the record. I would submit that was probably not an appropriate basis for any factual finding, given that nothing about that particular TV show was introduced into the case. To the extent that was the basis at all for the Circuit Court's decision, that would be inappropriate and would be reason not to defer at all to the Circuit Court. But returning to my point, that the notion that the techniques are somewhere available in the world or even widely available has been extensively discussed in the Exemption 7E case law. And what that case law uniformly says is the fact that the techniques are publicly available somewhere is not reason enough for Exemption 7E not to apply. The test that those courts have applied is whether disclosure of even techniques that are known in this particular context would lessen the technique's effectiveness. And what I would submit, and the critical point that the lower courts here did not respond to, is that among the whole universe of techniques to capture sexual predators, if Wisconsin sexual predators know that these are the specific techniques, the six or seven, that Wisconsin prosecutors and police are not only know about, but are being specifically trained in these trainings to look for. Those are the ones that the sexual predators are going to seek to evade. And that, with respect, again, the lower courts didn't even engage with that critical point, which I think undermines the basis for their decision.
So is it your position that it is not the specific techniques that are protectable, it is that those techniques are what are used by the local law enforcement officers?
That's right, Your Honor. As I mentioned, nothing really new under the sun these days in the information age. But the Exemption 7E cases, which again, this court in Linsmeyer specifically instructed custodians to look to.
To look to, but not be controlled by. I mean, clearly the FOIA laws are more restrictive than the public policy advanced for years by the legislature and the Department of Justice about the import in Wisconsin of public records. The FOIA, the Federal Freedom of Information Act, is more restrictive, so we can look to it for some guidance, but we're not controlled because there's a different principle at work that is not as subject to public record dissemination as we have as the statement of legislative policy in this state.
May I respond, Your Honor?
Please.
So in some ways, the open records law in Wisconsin is more restrictive. In some ways, it's less restrictive. There's certain exceptions in one, but not the other. But, I mean, if I may...
You want me to... Is it Linsmeyer? What case quotes and specifically states that it's more restrictive than FOIA?
I'm not saying that. What Linsmeyer said...
I mean, FOIA is more restrictive than the state of Wisconsin's policy on public records.
What Linsmeyer said in particular is that for law enforcement techniques, not in other areas, not across the board, for law enforcement techniques in particular, the record custodians are to look to Exemption 7 as the framework. And in fact, the whole last third of Linsmeyer is just going through the specific exemptions, A, B, C, D, E, F, of the Exemption 7, and explaining why the Linsmeyer approach didn't require keeping it in there. But I think it's pretty clear, and the message to custodians was pretty clear, is look to Exemption 7 as a framework. And not at all saying that in other areas outside the law enforcement context, the federal FOIA should be the test or the touchstone, but I think it is particularly useful here because, and this case shows why it's particularly useful, is this notion of training techniques and things of that sort, that hasn't really been fleshed out in Wisconsin case law. Wisconsin court cases haven't had the opportunity really to grapple with these difficult questions.
No, Wisconsin has a different approach, and ours is the balancing approach, right?
Yes.
That's just embedded in the evolution of our public records law in Chapter 19.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And so this is what Linsmeyer does. Linsmeyer acknowledges that balancing test, and that it says in paragraph 26 that when you're dealing with police records, that those are the kind of records that are most often going to weigh in favor of non-disclosure. And then it tells custodians how to do that, how to look in this very specific area, and how to decide whether these particularly sensitive documents are such that overcome the very laudable public policy of disclosure in the state, just in the law enforcement context. That's what Linsmeyer said.
In fact, Linsmeyer did, after going through that framework, but importantly, embracing and applying the balancing test that we hold dear in this state, at least up to this point, Linsmeyer Court concluded no, the records should be released. Isn't that correct?
Absolutely, Your Honor, and the Department of Justice strongly favors the balancing test. We are strongly in favor of the open records law. We'll be up before this court in less than a month and a half arguing for a very broad interpretation of the open records law.
What impact did the Act 283, that is the victim rights legislation that's referred to in this case, have on open records, the release of public records in this state?
With regard to this case, the reason that statute is relevant is the same reason that the constitutional amendment recognizing victim rights is particularly relevant. You discussed earlier, just a couple of minutes ago, what makes Wisconsin open records law
unique
versus the federal FOIA. And then I said that the federal FOIA is sometimes less restrictive and more restrictive. Something very unique about Wisconsin, not just open records law, but Wisconsin law in general and the Wisconsin Constitution in general, is the specific protections of victim rights that are embedded in the Wisconsin Constitution. So to the extent that one looks to public policies in deciding whether records are to be released, when you're dealing with the Wisconsin open records law, you will err on the side of victims perhaps more than a federal court would be to err on the side of victims in a federal FOIA case, precisely because our Constitution, enshrined in our Constitution, is a protection of victims that isn't in the federal Constitution. So that's something special about Wisconsin.
Yes, but that's the constitutional provision and the statutory
implementation, if you will, that gave more definition to the constitutional provision was then Attorney General Van Hollen in April 27, 2012 memo indicated that this new amendment and the new legislation, this was relied upon by the circuit court judge, the new statutory provisions created by Act 283 do not, underlined, prohibit law enforcement agencies or other public entities from disclosing personal identifiers of crime victims and witnesses in response to record requests, making records available for inspection pursuant to public records. And we say public records, open meetings, I think. So it's not open records. I think it's public records. For inspection pursuant to public records law is an official duty of public officers and employees and a routine function of the government agencies by which they're employed. That was the position of the DOJ in April of 2012 with regard to the victim rights legislation and amendment. Is everything in that April 27th, 2012 memo from then Attorney Van Hollen, upon which the circuit court relied, still the position of the Department of Justice?
Your Honor, if you're referring to the letter that we sent back to the requester denying the request, we have not made all of the arguments that are in that. For example, one of the bases that was cited in that letter was attorney-client privilege. We have not made that argument. With regard to the particular legislation, we've only used it as general guidance. We are not saying that the legislation prohibited the release. I'm happy to discuss the general victims' rights aspect of this case, which we do think protects these videos, especially the 2013 video, but we're not relying directly on that legislation, and we're not relying directly on every single line of that denial.
Yeah, so the answer in part to my question, which you just gave, thank you, but also is that you aren't going back on or contradicting anything in Attorney General Van Hollen's memorandum regarding how public records should be dealt with vis-a-vis victim rights. That's still the position of the DOJ?
Your Honor, the position of the DOJ with regard to victims' rights issues in this case is most fully spelled out by our briefing in front of this court. The open records law requires a very fast turnaround to get information back and responses back. For example, I think it's most obvious from the fact that attorney-client privilege was invoked in that letter, and we later, upon further analysis, we decided that was not a basis to oppose these record requests. With regard to the victim's rights aspect of this case, we have certainly refined our position. We do not feel ourselves bound by the specific decisions or the specific structure of the arguments with regard to victims made in that letter, but we do think...
Counsel, I'm sorry, but I'm not quite sure what you mean by the letter. I'm referring to the memorandum that the circuit court made reference to of April 27th, 2012, subject effect of 2011 Act 283 on the official duties of law enforcement agencies and other public entities under the Wisconsin Public Records Law. That's what I've been referring to.
Right. I apologize, Your Honor. I haven't fully studied whether every aspect of that Attorney General opinion or memo is still the policy of the Department of Justice. I would assume it is, but what I'm here presenting is how the public interest in protecting victims applies to this particular case, and we have not said that particular statute that's discussed in that Attorney General opinion prohibited the release. What we cited was the constitutional amendment, that statute, and this court's case law for the general notion that in Wisconsin, more than in the federal FOIA, more than in many other states, victims are given special primacy. And with regard to that interest, disclosing these videos, especially the 2013 video, would, in the words of this court in Hempel, have a chilling effect on victims. We have an undisputed affidavit before the courts from our Director of Office Victim Services, Jill Karofsky, which says that victims are highly sensitive to having their victimization publicized and republicized. She refers to this as re-traumatization. If victims know that the horrific things that happened to them, even if they're initially made public, will years later be republicized. The undisputed record evidence in this case is they will be chilled from coming forward. In the horrific crime that was at issue in the 2013 video, there were 39 victims before anybody came forward. That is a sign of how scared victims are to come forward. And re-traumatization through the release of a video like this would make that worse. And that is an important public policy reason why these videos, especially the 2013 video, should not be released to the public.
Wouldn't for that to be a basis for not releasing the information, wouldn't the information on the tape have to be personally identifiable to the particular?
Your Honor, there are certain provisions in the Wisconsin open records law or public records law. I know it's called public records law, but a lot of this court's opinion, including the open records law, there are certain things that relate to personally identifiable information, and there's special protections for that. And those people for whom the personally identifiable information is for have special rights. They're the only ones that can challenge pre-release. If the Department of Justice decided to release something, they're the only ones that can challenge the pre-release. But that is not exhaustive of victim rights. And in fact, in Hempel, this court specifically cited victims in general and the chilling in general of victims from a disclosure as a sufficient public interest, apart from the personally identified information aspect of the open records law, which again creates special protections. And you can see this in Hempel itself, because the first part of Hempel talks about the argument in that case that this is personally identifiable information. They say, you say you lose under that. And then they go on to do the general public's balancing test without the personal identifiable. So it's two different inquiries.
Counsel, your very argument, I think, was undermined by the presentation in the 2013 video, part two, at 17 minutes, 15 seconds, 17 minutes to 45 seconds. When the presenter indicated in response to situation of releasing 9/11 calls, that those releases can re-victimize victims.
Mm-hmm.
And the presenter said that you have to release those, even though they sometimes adjust or modify the voice to protect the caller. It says, unless it compromises the investigation, endangers victims, or causes victims to be intimidated. Without those factors, you can't make the balancing test work. So isn't that the very thing you're advocating here, that this whole re-victimization is the reason that you shouldn't release the information, even though there's no personally identifying information on these tapes?
Your Honor, may I answer?
Yes, please.
Well, with regard to the presenter, obviously the presenter was making many statements. He wasn't applying the open records law in all its details. He was just making comments. This court in Newspapers, Inc. Said that police blotters had to be released. Maybe he was referring to that. But ultimately, the interpretation of the open records law in a particular case is for this court on de novo review. We presented our arguments. We presented our timestamp citations, and we hope that this court agrees. But ultimately, it's this court's decision on de novo review.
I have two issues. One,
is this something that you could say for rebuttal? Because
no,
he will be back.
You have an opportunity at the trial court level, and perhaps even at the Court of Appeals, to seek redaction. You did not. You deliberately refused that. And yet here you say, should the court hold against you, this matter should go back to the trial court to see if certain parts should be redacted. Haven't you forfeited that argument?
No, Your Honor. In Linsmeyer, the court, after ordering release, sent back four redactions. Our position is that the whole of the two videos are protected from disclosure, and that is continues to be our position. Of course, if this court only agrees with that position in part, but believes that in part the public interest is harmed after conducting a de novo review, surely this court is not bound to visit harm on the public interest.
Okay, that's my second point. Relates to a rules petition we had. It was, I think, 1504, where the proponents thought that the court should adopt a rule that allows attorneys to speak about cases for educational purposes. The court didn't adopt that. And so I wanted, and this may be outside of what you're here to talk about or that you have any reference to, whether that has any effect on this case and who the AG's or who the DA's client is.
Your Honor, I don't want to speak out of school about
Pardon
that.
Pardon me?
Your Honor, I don't want to speak out of school on that one. I'm not particularly familiar with that. But
okay.
Okay. Thank
so
you very
you're
much.
Not, you're not, you didn't check that out.
Okay. I will, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Michael Bauer. I'm representing the Democratic Party of Wisconsin and Corey Liebman in this matter. I think on an annual basis, the Attorney General's office helpfully puts out a publication, guidelines to the public, municipal attorneys and the like, on public records law, and they do a separate one for open meetings law. I just want to read you how Attorney General Schimmel, in his introduction, started the most recent edition, which was December of 2015, because I think it really emphasizes the uniqueness of Wisconsin law when it comes to public disclosure. He wrote, "It's imperative that we recognize that transparency is the cornerstone of democracy and that citizens cannot hold their elected officials accountable in a representative government unless government is performed in the open." And I think that that statement, that overriding legislative policy, because of course it comes directly from the state statutes, is important in this case because ultimately this case is one of a balancing test. I think that the burden is on, in this case, the Department of Justice to show at some level, I think beyond even preponderance of the evidence level, that their reasons for suppressing these two, I always call them videotapes, but they're actually CDs, has to outweigh the legislative dictate that records are generally open to the public and for review. And I think that's especially important in this case. And we're talking about two videos, remember, a 2009 video, which was really, I think the trial court described it as catching internet predators 101. And I think the court accurately portrayed that video. And I urge the court to look at it. And as I finally had a chance in preparation for this briefing and argument to review it, and without getting into specifics so as to not violate the protective order, I think if you look at that 2009 videotape, you come away with what's so novel and to be protected here. It really is basic, well-known investigative techniques used by law enforcement that, frankly, you get in a lot more detail, as the trial court mentioned, by not only Catch the Predator TV shows, but, you know, there's a host of them that you can watch. There's a whole channel, I understand now, that is nothing but crime investigations with detailed techniques that go well beyond what was in that 2009 case. I don't practice criminal law, but I review on occasion the advance sheets that relate to criminal matters. And I'd venture to guess that this court in its decisions get into even greater detail as to investigative techniques than District Attorney Schimmel did in that 2009
Counsel,
case.
Mr. Bell, on what are you relying for your affirmation that because the circuit court said there was nothing novel here, that's part of the test, part of the balance? I've never, until I read the trial court statement, I don't remember seeing that in any case that I reviewed saying, if it's not novel, then you really have a harder time saying you're not going to release it. I read what the trial court said, and I have watched all of the videos, so I know exactly what's in there. And I don't understand the novel part. That's what I want you to explain to me, if you can, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think, again, we're looking at a balancing test, so it's one of many issues, and one of them is what putatively could be released as to a technique of law enforcement. Is that something that if the either a current or a potential criminal could view, is that something that he wouldn't otherwise know and see from a host of other sources? So I think it's not a one defining issue that if it's novel, therefore it should be released, but I think it goes to the balancing test.
Mr. Bauer, let's say that each of the techniques identified in the 2009 CD are entirely unremarkable on their own. What do you make of Mr. Saitlin's claim that by agglomerating those into one CD and suggesting that those are the factors that law enforcement in Wisconsin pay particular attention to, that summation of techniques becomes something that needs to be protected?
I'm not sure if the individual techniques in and of themselves is something that could be released. The fact that it's compiled in one handy video, I don't think necessarily matters. Again, though, Your Honor, it does go. I suppose that would be one factor, again, as the court performs its balancing test,
right. Well,
that maybe it would be in favor of not disclosing.
Yeah, so let's say that there's, just to pick a number out of the air, 100 different techniques that one could use to track down a sex offender. And in the state of Wisconsin, prosecutors and police officers are trained to concentrate on 10 of those. Is it not important which of the 10 the law enforcement officers in Wisconsin are concentrating on?
I'd go back to my previous answer. That might be a point for not disclosing, but in the grand balancing test, I don't think it would be anything that would be a major factor in the court ordering non-disclosure. I mean, I'm not an expert in internet crimes against children and child porn, but we're talking about a tape that is now over 6 years old that talked about techniques, and I do know. I think we all know that how things have changed on the internet and things, that my guess is that a lot of those techniques, beyond being widely publicized, are probably not likely to be relevant anymore at this point. The second tape has to is the 2013 tape, and that really is, I think, as it was described by the court again, was sort of a case study of the Stancil case, a widely publicized sextortion case in Waukesha County. And I think that tape, that video in particular, has to goes to the issue of the exemption of victims' rights. A couple points. One is, I think we all understand, not a single victim was named or identified in that training video.
Counsel, I watched the video, and I would agree with you that they weren't named. I don't agree with you that you couldn't identify who they were, because it said what high school they went, it said the dates that they were at that high school, it said the dates on which the crime occurred. If you went back and you looked back at the old papers that were put out at that time, you would find initials, which are not used in the video, but there were, according to what I've read, a concern that students would be able to identify other students, and in fact, at the time, that did occur, with some students identifying who had been a victim in this
39 or 37 student operation that was going on. So to say they couldn't be identified, they don't have the names, but I don't agree you couldn't identify who those people were if you wanted to figure it out.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I think the point is, and I think there were upwards to the 40 victims, I think, and part of then DA Schimmel's presentation was some students, and also I believe at least the one publication, Gentleman's Quarterly, was able to connect the dots, obviously not from his video, but from the criminal complaint, which is a public record, and was able to connect his dots. And that was the lesson that, the good lesson that District Attorney, now Attorney General Schimmel, was making is, you know, let's be extra careful in the future how we identify victims, because he did it by initials and they were able to track it. But that came from the criminal complaint. I don't believe, if you look at the video, you could connect those dots
that way. If you put that video viral today, and it went, and it was used by people that prey on children, you're telling me those people wouldn't figure that out, and anybody who wanted to see it, that when it was on the internet, wouldn't go back and connect the dots? I mean, you can find the criminal complaint too. But just because it was disclosed at one time and people figured out who were the victims, at least some of the victims, that doesn't mean that we don't care for those victims today to keep them from having their identities disclosed yet again.
Right. We care, and we don't want, I think, in trial court, I made it clear my client's not interested in victimizing or re-victimizing any of them.
No, and I would think you wouldn't, and your client wouldn't.
Right. I think it's important, though, there is case law that says that one, again, as we do this balancing test, one of the factors that we look at is, has this information been out there in other forms before? And whether we like it or not, the reality is this information has been out there in much more detailed fashion in newspaper articles, magazine articles, many of which the District Attorney Schimmel participated in interviews in the criminal complaint. And other public documents.
Well, Mr. Ballard, this isn't like a trade secret that finds its way into the public. Right? So that once the information becomes publicly known, its value dissipates as a secret. This is about an individual or individuals who've been victimized, and the harm comes each time that it is publicized. Don't you agree with that?
I wouldn't disagree with you, Your Honor, on that. I would point out, though, and again, I think the trial court found this as well. Opposing counsel referenced an affidavit they submitted at the trial court by Assistant Attorney General Karofsky, who, at least at the time, was also the head of the Crime Victims Bureau at DOJ. And if you read that affidavit, as the trial court did, I think you would agree with the trial court that she made no specific finding that this release of this particular video would re-victimize anyone. She made a general statement that we need to be careful about re-victimization, but there was no, and I went through it several times myself, you go through it, I don't think you're going to find where she specifically says that any of these 40 individuals, these 40 victims, would somehow be affected by what was said in the 2013 video. And I think that's an important finding of the trial court. The Department of Justice, not in their initial denial, not in the trial court, I don't believe in the Court of Appeals, ever raised the issue of sort of asking this court to adopt the 7E federal standard. I think it would be a mistake and completely contrary to the spirit and the letter of Wisconsin law to do so. And I think important it is to read part of that federal statute. And it ends, it says, Exemption 7E permits withholding of, quote, records or information compiled for law enforcement purposes, but only to the extent that the production of such enforcement records or information would disclose techniques and procedure for law enforcement investigations or prosecutions, or would disclose guidelines for law enforcement investigation or prosecution, if such disclosure could reasonably be expected to risk circumvention of the law. Reasonably be expected. That is contrary, that sort of standard, which I agree with the attorneys from the Department of Justice, that is a very low standard. And I think if you look at a lot of the federal case law, especially when it comes to national security issues and things like that, trial courts, federal courts are defer to that because that is such a low standard. That's not the standard that the people of Wisconsin, the state legislature decided to apply to cases here in the state of Wisconsin. I urge this court to reject that standard. That's for the state legislature. If they want to adopt an exemption like that, they should take it up, debate it, pass it, and have the governor sign that sort of exemption.
Would you agree, Counselor, that we look at these tapes under two different tests? We are perhaps applying victims' rights concerns found in Wisconsin's Constitution and elsewhere to the 2013 tape. But from your argument and from opposing counsel's argument, it doesn't sound like victims' rights arguments are made for the 2009 tape. Is that correct or not?
Yeah, I think the 2009 tape strictly talked about investigative techniques on child porn and ICAC cases. I think that's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
As I have read these cases, seems to me Lindsmeyer references 7E, but that you have lots of other cases that say, okay, you can look at the feds, but it's a very, very different statute, so don't get all tied up with it.
I agree. I mean, I know in my response brief here, I didn't spend a lot of time because, and I think case law is clear, yeah, we can use in Wisconsin FOIA to sort of as guidance, but to me, it's a completely different statutory scheme that's really for the legislature to decide whether or not we want to carve that exception to the public sunshine laws of Wisconsin.
What I hear you arguing is maybe as a general rule, you can say that victims are re-traumatized if the issue is brought up again. That is, if it's brought to light, whether it's public, private, small, or large. But that's not the test. That the test is not generally whether victims will be re-traumatized, but whether in this particular case, with this particular tape, under the circumstances of the Stencil case, the balance for the victims overcomes the balance for open records.
I think that's a well-articulated view of my argument. I think also of what the trial court and the Court of Appeals found in this case.
So just saying generally victims are re-traumatized when the case is raised again in some fashion. Everyone knows that they might very well be re-traumatized, but that general kind of statement is not good enough. It has to be brought to focus in the particulars of and circumstances of this case. And so then my question to you is, what are the circumstances in this case that argue against putting weight on re-traumatization? For example, heavily revealed previously. I mean, I want you to give me the factors that weigh against the concept of re-traumatize here.
Right. I think one is I think you do go back to the fact that there's not a individually. This isn't a case where there's a victim that's personally identified. I happen to think also difficult to connect the dots with them as well, which would make it one where the re-victimization is unlikely. I think that that also is again, I mean, I wouldn't disagree with the affidavit of Assistant AG Karofsky that generally we should be concerned about victimization and re-victimization, but I don't believe that in, as she did, in my view, that this specific case is an issue of re-victimization by, again, as you do the balancing test. I mean, there is interest on the other side of, I mean, Brad Schimmel was the district attorney at the time. He's the attorney general now, so I think there, some of the court's cases from this court have said that, you know, we especially shine the light bright on elected officials and the like, as we should in this case. So I think there's the balance that goes toward disclosure in that case. In the 2009 tape, I go back again to how, and it was happened to be Assistant Attorney General Karofsky who concluded the presentation, if you look at it, and her response after she listened to this whatever hour-plus presentation as to, you know, a lot of details, a lot of case law citing on, you know, how to draft a proper search warrant and the like. But her overriding lesson she took from that was, boy, I'm nervous now because I'm a parent of a 13-year-old. And I think that's a legitimate concern. And that goes to the trial court then who made the statement that in some ways I think there's an argument that, you know, keeping, and now I'm talking about the 2009 tape, keeping these things secret and cloistered only within law enforcement doesn't do the public any good because they continue to need to know what happens. I think the same applies when it comes to...
Mr. Yes. I'm wondering if you might be able to give a more in-depth response to Justice Abrahamson's question, specifically with respect to this. Let's say you can connect the dots and presentation back to a specific victim. How would that not almost categorically not be a re-victimization of that person? What factors might exist that would say, even though you can identify who this tape is talking about, we can be comfortable that they're not going to suffer re-victimization?
Yeah, I think if I were to concede that you could connect the dots based on the details on the 2013 video, that would be a factor that would heavily weigh in favor of keeping them. That would, in essence, be not much different, right, than naming the people, you know, and if that's what you view from the after viewing those videos, that you think that that's the case, I think that's a major factor that would, an understandable reason not to do it. Now, there's probably, I'd have to look back at the tape, my guess is of that hour 10 presentation, you know, it's probably only a portion of it that really talks about those sort of specifics, so it may be something you go back for redaction purposes.
So if we were to conclude that in certain circumstances the 2013 recording was capable of personally identifying a victim, would it be your request that be redacted and the balance be produced?
All right, I think that would be the proper way of handling it. There was one instance that I won't get into that I think even the trial court acknowledged maybe was something that best we could tell that wasn't made public. I offered then, I offered now that would be appropriate for redaction. I don't think that doesn't need to be made public.
Well, you offered redaction. It was refused. It can be interpreted as twice, the trial court and court of appeals. It's not discussed heavily in the DOJ brief. It's just at the end in what their conclusion is. If you hold against us, send it back for redaction. You have no objection to redaction, or was it a forfeited issue?
You're right, Your Honor. At the trial court, I made a request to Department of Justice to look in camera at the videos. I was denied. I filed a protective order, and the trial court decided to issue its decision without any need for me to look at it. Part of the reason I wanted to look at it was, A, I thought we could narrow really what was my client was potentially looking for, and two was to if there was something that the Department of Justice said, this we think is, especially the victim stuff, really going to cause a problem, it would have been something that I would hope we'd been able to stipulate and not even have been part of the case.
Does it matter to you that the trial court made a finding that the videos show nothing that can be considered misconduct on the part of any of the presenters?
You know, does it matter to me? I mean, I'm not
balance.
Sure. Yeah, right. To the, I don't think the balancing. Of course, there's case law that says the purpose and the reason that somebody wants a videotape is really irrelevant to the request.
I'm talking about
that. So if you're talking about that, does that finding have an effect on the balancing? I guess that when one of the things that you're balancing is this, whether or not there's any wrongdoing or anything on the elected official, and he made a finding that he didn't see that, I suppose that would be something that would go on that side of the ledger, yes, Your Honor.
Was the finding by the trial court no wrongdoing on the part of the elected official, or was it, as the Chief Justice said, no wrongdoing on the part of any of the presenters?
It was. Well, I have the transcript, and it does say presenters.
Right. She asked. You reframed the question.
Okay. I'm sorry. Could you ask it again? I'll okay. I thought I answered it specifically.
Reading from the transcript, it says this video shows nothing that can be considered misconduct on the part of any of the presenters, at least as far as I could see.
Right. And I think, with the exception of maybe an introduction, I think the only presenter in either one of the videos was now Attorney General Schimmel, if I remember right.
Mm-hmm. The circuit court made the statement, I'm looking at a quote actually from slip opinion page 4 of the Court of Appeals. While Schimmel provided a great deal of detail, he did not share any identifying information about the victims. Help me with this analysis. The circuit court the Court of Appeals indicated that this was a finding of fact by the circuit court. Assume that in the 2013 tape, that there in the tape in and of itself is no identifying information about the victims. Assume that when the complaint was filed, it contained initials of the victims and date of births. Assume that students from the high school may have gone to the yearbook and clever as they can be, ascertained the names. Of what import is it that although there is no personal identifying information in the 2013 video, that personal identifying information had been interpreted based on information set forth in the complaint within days after the complaint was filed? But, you know, it's not contained in this document. I think there's no contest that the electronic recordings are records, as I understand the position of the parties. Others may see it differently. I am hard-pressed to see in the 2013 video itself any personal identifying information. but there had been when Wired magazine allegedly printed the complaint in full. So how do you connect that? This record doesn't have it. When the complaint was filed, people figured it out when they printed the complaint in full.
You're right. I mean, I think I might have stated this before, that in my view, and in the trial court's view, clearly no victims were named. I don't think, just alone by the video, if it was a high schooler or whatever, that they could connect the dots. Now, if they took the complaint, because the complaint, criminal complaint, which, as I understand it, is, I know it was initially published, I think, online and then taken down, but it's still, I mean, I went there, it's a public record. If you took the video with the complaint, you could perhaps connect some dots. But frankly, you could do it much better just with the complaint, and the video is sort of irrelevant. I would, again, and I hate to always fall back on the same argument, I suppose that might be a small matter that you put in favor of, because they can, from extraneous sources, they can maybe identify someone that you put in favor of keeping the video from public scrutiny and disclosure.
Well, they've already been identified. I mean, that's my point.
The criminal complaint is so much more detailed than anything that District Attorney Schimmel talked about in the presentation as to the victims, maybe but for that, the one instance, really.
Well, isn't the video just a reminder about this notorious case? So that if you replay it, what you've done is remind everybody in Waukesha County, the state of Wisconsin, country, and internationally, that there was such a case. And that only brings forth that there were victims, and the victims, therefore, are reminded once again that there was such a case.
So I think that's right. I mean, it was...
That's,
you know,
what the victim...
the whole case sort of the national stature that it got was, you know, the whole sextortion. That was the first time I had heard that word and things. And I would agree then with what, and I think it was in one of the newspaper articles rather than the video, but the lesson that District Attorney Schimmel took from that case, he said it should be a 2x4 upside the head of parents. So I go back to that again. It's more of a educational tool than it was something that went to some of the law enforcement issues.
Now there's at least one reference in 2013 that states a non-public. If you could track that everything else is in the public record, or was in a press conference, or was in the media, or whatever, that fact apparently was not. And that in and of itself may be reason for redaction. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think, as I said prior, that but for that one specific incident, I think this, all of these details have been in much more explicit detail out there in general publications, newspapers. I think the trial court said he did a search on the Stansel case and quickly found 15,000 plus references to it and the like. Again, if there's any redaction necessary, in my view, it would be strictly as to that one incident, just to make sure we don't cause any undue harm to any victims.
What's the public purpose in disclosing either of these cases? I understand there's a presumption that disclosure is in the public interest, but now we've gotten information placed by the other side before us that the first tape shows the methods of training law enforcement to catch people who prey on children. And the second one has, some would argue, identifiable information, if not names. So what do you place now? They put something on the balance on this side. So how do I weigh that against, and what's on the side of the scales for disclosure now? Once they put that out there, don't you have to do something? Can you just say, you didn't overcome the presumption? Don't you have to say why it's in the public's benefit to disclose these particular tapes?
It might be one of the factors. I think, as I mentioned before, I happen to think there might be some educational aspects to it. There is the scrutiny of public officials. Just because I look at it and a trial court looks at it, I think that we have rights as citizens to see, unless it's weighted the other way. Public officials are now attorney general, make presentations to sort of weigh what he may have said. And I think, again, the trial court, I think, said it. It's sort of the flip. Yes, the citizens have a right to know if a public official does something improper, but the flip of it is if, in fact, he's not doing it, the public has that right to know. But I ultimately go back to the issue of the overriding legislative policy, and that's why I think this court should affirm the Court of Appeals, remand back maybe for purposes of that one redaction, and also for a determination whether fees and costs are appropriate. Thank you.
So that's what the remand would be, fees and costs. And any redaction.
Correct.
So you have no objection to that?
I do not.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Rebuttal, please.
Just three brief points, Your Honors. First, opposing counsel noted that his client wasn't particularly interested in releasing some of the sex-sensitive things that are on the 2013 video. But, of course, that is irrelevant to the public records law issue. If, in fact, this is a public record, it can be requested tomorrow by some sicko on some message board and posted on YouTube, and then victims will see the YouTube count, how many people watched it. That is re-traumatization. That would occur if this video was released, especially the 2013 video, even with some redactions. It would be a bad day in the household of every one of those victims. That's point one. Point two, counsel mentioned that some of the techniques on the 2009 video might be different now. This was one of the criticisms that I lodged in the reply brief. Surely, if there were certain techniques that we identified in our timestamps that counsel thinks are now stale, counsel could have identified, well, you know, at such and such a time, that technique is stale, court should look at it. We looked at it, we don't think any of those techniques are stale, and certainly there hasn't been any specific argumentation to point this court to a particular technique that was useful in 2009 but no longer would be used. A lot of them dealt with the psychology of how these folks work, and those, you know, psychology is timeless, more or less. Finally, and this is a point I didn't get to in my original presentation, I think it's also important to take into account the long-term public policy implications of ordering release in the circumstance. This is a discrete thing. These are trainings that happen a couple times a year. They're videotaped so that those that can't show up can watch them. If this court says that those kind of trainings need to be released, one of two things is going to happen. One, presenters are going to clip their own wings so that they would give anything that they could possibly think would be useful to sexual predators or whatever the criminal is being discussed. Or two, the video cameras would be turned off so that then people who can't attend the meetings won't be able to view them.
What's so problematic about turning the video cameras off when the record here shows that in at least a period of 6 years, if not more, all of the videos, not just this one, all of the videos ever recorded for these trainings by DOJ had been checked out a maximum of 5 or 6 times over a period that encompassed at least 6 years. I mean, they're not being used much. So if you have concerns, don't record them. The idea where you have to record them for people to view doesn't mesh with the reality of over 6 years of experience.
Your Honor, thank you for that question. I have two answers to that. First of all, technology is changing. There's many more abilities to upload files and things of that sort that used to have to be viewed in person. We hope that as technology and ways to shrink files increases, people will be able to view them much more readily under our secure system. And that's something that would happen in the future where it hasn't happened in the past. But second of all, and this is very important, because the circuit court also said, why don't you turn the cameras off? That is not the policy of the public records law. The public records law is not there designed to encourage public officials not to create public records. If the records are such that they should not be disclosed, they should not be disclosed. There should not be an instruction to the Department of Justice, well, don't create public records to begin with. That is not at all what the legislature attempted to accomplish.
I mean, we have judicial education, as the trial court referenced in its opinion. We don't record our judicial education presentations. And I don't think that we are, as a judicial system, overtly attempting to hide anything. We don't record them. I don't know why. Maybe it is because, just like the DOJ is experiencing, there's no need for them. No one wants them. I mean, I don't know why only 5 or 6 of all of the recordings have only been checked out in a period that's at least 6 years. I mean, it doesn't look like much a need. And our branch of government doesn't perceive a need to record these things, and we're not hiding anything.
Your Honor, I absolutely understand that, but the practice is currently to record. And what the circuit court suggested and what was suggested there would be to take a purposeful decision not to create public records. Whatever the public policy of the public records law, it can't be that. It can't be to encourage us not to create public records. And, you know, the fact that some people have not been properly viewed doesn't mean they won't be properly viewed in the future, but we can guarantee they won't be properly viewed and won't be put to useful purposes if we do, in fact, turn off our cameras. And I think that's the way that I would sum up this case. As Chief Justice mentioned a couple times, there's really no good that would come from releasing these two tapes. But there would be a lot of bad. There would be bad in helping sexual predators get away with their crimes, and it would be bad for victims. And in that public interest balance, non-disclosure wins out. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you both for very, very interesting talking. We had a really interesting day today with great attorneys and really significant issues, and once again this afternoon. So thank you both. We enjoyed your briefs very much, and we will give them careful attention as we build your arguments. And we are adjourned to reconvene in closed conference at 3:15.